I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. Today, we're covering The State versus Fred Freeman, episodes 3 and 4. If you haven't yet listened to those episodes, stop listening to this right now and go back and do that. We will be here when you get back. Joining me to talk about what we have learned about this case is Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law and one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast and my favorite legal series. Hello, Colin. Thank you so much for convening this group to talk about this case.
Hey, Rebecca. Thanks for hosting.
And by the way, thank you for bringing this completely bizarre and crazy case to the world's attention. I know that I'm really glad that you did, and I'm sure others feel the same.
Yeah, the feedback we've gotten on this series in particular has been people just aghast that this led to a conviction and has led to appeals being denied over the years.
Well, and speaking of the legal process around this, on the line with us also is Imran Syed. He's Fred's attorney. He's clinical assistant professor of law and the assistant director of the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Imran, it's wonderful to talk to you about this case and about your client.
Wonderful to be here. I'm really, really grateful for the amazing production you put together about Fred's case, and really happy to answer any questions.
And finally with us again is Herb Welser. He's a private investigator. He's been working on this case for years. He spent 31 years with the Port Huron, Michigan Police Department, that being the police agency that originally investigated this case. Herb, it's nice to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you too.
And I just want to let our audience know, please be forgiving of any extraneous home noises you may hear during this podcast. We are recording this during a pandemic. I know I have dogs upstairs. There might be a UPS truck that arrives. They might bark. My sons may accidentally walk in the room. I think other people have babies at home. So just please be patient and forgiving, as we are all being right now. So for a quick summary of episodes 3 and 4 of this series. In episode 3, the Undisclosed team discussed 1, Bob Evans, the prosecutor's private pilot, who supported the state's crazy plane theory. That's right, I just called it crazy. 2, Philip Joplin, the jailhouse informant who implicated Fred Freeman at trial before subsequently recanting. And 3, David Dean, Fred Freeman's trial attorney, who was later disbarred based on cocaine abuse and stealing from clients. And in episode 4, the team covered 1, Fred Freeman's ex-girlfriend, Crystal Merrill, and whether her stories about Freeman's ninja skills and Yakuza membership were fact or fiction. Spoiler alert, they were probably fiction. And 2, what happened during Freeman's appeals. And 3, the possibility of an alternate suspect. And also in episode 4, we were introduced to another character at the very end. And she's with us now, Paula Randolph. You are Fred Freeman, Kejimin Tensu's partner. He talked about you at the end of episode 4. It's really lovely to talk to you. Can you just talk a little bit about how you guys met and how you feel about this case?
Sure, thanks. So I started writing to Temujin after I read the Nolan article right after Christmas time. You know, here I was all thankful for my blessings and filled with a Christmas spirit, but I just couldn't sleep. You know, I was so, you know, afflicted really on his behalf, because I just couldn't imagine what he was going through. And, you know, I felt really strongly that I needed to know if he had good people in his life, because I was just from the small area that convicted him. And, you know, he wasn't just stripped of years of his life, but decades. So I reached out, something I would normally never do, but, you know, he's just very personable. He's very easy to talk to. And, you know, we clicked on so many issues. About this case, I'm appalled that this happened to him. It just really, it bothered me. And so we started talking and then writing, and, you know, our friendship blossomed.
Oh, Paula, we're losing you. Okay, so listeners, you should know Paula has a very tenuous phone connection. Last we heard is you said that your friendship blossomed, obviously it blossomed into romance. And did you hear the episode, and did you hear all the wonderful things he had to say about you?
I did, yes. You know, he's just a wonderful man, and I'm grateful to have him in my life. You know, I ask myself sometimes, you know, it's kind of crazy. And I think to myself, how did we even get here? But it was just something that we both knew was meant to be. And, you know, I'm given just a lot of peace about him, something I can't really explain. But I really have no apprehension about moving forward with him in my life.
Hmm. That's really something. Now, Imran, it's really nice to speak with you as, you know, a person. You probably don't know this about me because you haven't been on the podcast before, but I'm a journalist by day. I've written several true crime books. I know a lot about the criminal justice system. I host a podcast about media around true crime. And I can tell you, Imran, I have never quite heard of a wrongful conviction like this one before. So many details have pretty much blown my mind, procedurally, evidentiary details. How did you first become involved in this case, and what were your first impressions when you started learning the facts that were presented at trial and how this whole thing played out?
I first started working on this case around 2010. Yeah, it would have been late 2010. I think just a few months before that, Fred's case had come to the Michigan Innocence Clinic, which was a new clinic at that time, founded at the University of Michigan Law School. And we focus only on non-DNA cases in our clinic. So we had a lot of, you know, armed robberies, bank robberies, you know, things where there might have been some ballistic evidence or just new witnesses to discover. And then, you know, Fred's case came in, and I was aware about it before I started working on it myself, because the public hearing was happening at the time for his clemency application with, you know, our governor two governors ago, back in 2010. And I remember one of the first things I did in this case was in August 2010, when I, you know, kind of drafted and formatted some things and sent them to Senator Carl Levin, Michigan senator at the time, so that he would support Fred's clemency application. And he did support it. And, you know, as you're well aware, over the years, many, many people, famous, less famous, lawyers, non-lawyers, have supported Fred's claims. So that was how I got started in it. I was still a law student at that time. I became an attorney and joined the clinic as an attorney in 2011. And then, you know, eventually the case came to be supervised by me, I think around 2015 or thereabouts. But I was part of the team kind of throughout his federal court process in 2012-13, his hearing, which happened in 2014 in state court. My impressions of the case, I think, are, you know, unfortunately, I don't have anything to add beyond what you've said and what I know a lot of your listeners feel, which is that this is just the most astounding wrongful conviction that there is. There are a whole number of factors that are unexplained in this case, a whole series of lines of evidence that should have never gotten in a trial, you know, violations that occurred at this trial that you could just kind of stack on top of each other. It's a very, very flawed conviction. Unfortunately, as we found in the line of work that we're in, those convictions, the ones that are really, really weak from the beginning, end up being very, very difficult to overturn because you know, the people behind the conviction are really defensive about it. Mm. And that's what we've seen over the years as we've brought new evidence forward, and, you know, Fred's encountered long before he ever dealt with us. It's just, you know, I just feel his claims are dealt with in a very, very dismissive manner by courts, almost as if they're afraid of what would happen if they opened the door even a little bit. And I think that's rooted in kind of a normal human tendency to, you know, not want to admit a mistake, and especially when it's such an egregious mistake. But we also, of course, over the course of time, have a tendency to come to convince ourselves that we've done the right thing. And I think a lot of the actors involved in this case just aren't able to see the case from a neutral perspective, as, you know, I'm glad to see all of your listeners and everyone on the podcast has been able to see.
Yeah, I mean, I am often very circumspect when I talk about even cases covered on Undisclosed. I mean, I know they're extremely well vetted before Undisclosed will do them. So it's not like I am doubtful that, you know, the conviction is strong or not. For me, it's just a question of trying to approach the conversations with a little bit of objectivity. And I find that to be impossible in this case. I mean, he didn't do it. There's no physical way he could have done it. The case is a fantasy. The witnesses are fantastical. And you even had a judge at one point, was it in 2012, who overturned the conviction, who said as much?
You're referring to the habeas opinion from the district judge, federal district judge Denise Page Hood, which, you know, I think was the only opinion that has come out in the past at least 25 years, maybe even 30 years, that has looked at the facts of this case, that has peeled back kind of the procedural hurdles and taken a look at what actually happened and, you know, did this person actually commit this crime? That's been a real challenge. As you know, Judge Hood's opinion was reversed by the Sixth Circuit. We filed a subsequent state court motion based on some significant new evidence about the photo array. We also filed a state court motion after that habeas was denied based on some significant new evidence about the photo array that Herb had discovered. And the challenge there was not so much that they were looking at our evidence and finding it unconvincing. It was just courts were refusing to look at the evidence. And, you know, initially we filed that motion. It was denied without a hearing. Then we got the Supreme Court to send it back for a hearing, our Michigan Supreme Court. And, you know, that was one of the most difficult and mind-blowing hearings I've ever been a part of, where even little things, even just very basic things that everyone always does at an evidentiary hearing were being challenged. And so, you know, the real challenge has just been to get someone to take a look at the evidence. And once they do, I think they conclude exactly what, you know, every one of your listeners probably concluded, which is that this just didn't happen. Instead of focusing on that, we've had to fight over, well, should he have found these photos in 2006 versus 2008? Should his direct appeal attorney have asked for them in 94 versus, you know, us asking for them now? Now, of course, the answers to all of these questions were given. He was looking for these photos for, you know, over the years. He had been told repeatedly that they don't exist, and then suddenly they did exist. So even the very difficult hurdles that have been put before Fred, I think he's overcome given the evidence and the arguments that have been made. But as you guys have probably come across in a lot of your other cases, the legal standards on post-conviction are just very, very difficult.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, we haven't prevailed to this point.
But Fred is a member of the Yakuza, right? No, I'm just kidding. We know he's not.
They're a sole member in their Michigan chapter, I suppose. He's not, just to be clear.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I have to say, it was one of my favorite details from episode 4 was when, you know, during the trial, Fred would nudge his attorney and be like, ask her if she's quoting that movie we watched together. It's like insane. Now, Herb, a lot of ground was covered in the 4 episodes of the podcast, but I'm sure there were details that you uncovered in your investigation over the years that were not included. Is there anything that you want to share that you'd like listeners to know?
Sure. Something I've wondered over the years, and I know many other people have wondered too, is why did the trial judge allow the prosecution to present so many things to the jury? And Imran spoke to that just a few minutes ago. But, you know, why did the judge allow the airplane theory to be brought in when there was no evidence of that? Why did the judge allow the extensive testimony as to the martial arts weapons when a shotgun was used? Why did the trial judge allow the hypnosis testimony? And even in the transcript, you can see where the trial judge said that in his opinion, there was no suggestiveness on the part of Dr. Mooney to Rennie Gobian. And in an earlier podcast, we heard from the expert who said that this is the worst case of hypnotic suggestiveness that they had ever seen. So one thing, trying to think of why possibly the trial judge may have allowed some of this, and this is just a possibility, but it's something to consider, is that prior to the trial, that the trial judge was arrested by the Michigan State Police for drunk driving.
Oh.
And I've interviewed the state police troopers who arrested him, and they arrested him in Port Huron Township. So the troopers told me that the judge was quite intoxicated. They transported him to the Michigan State Police Post in St. Clair. They began to process him for the drunk driving arrest, and apparently a phone call or phone calls were made, and at that point, a fellow St. Clair County Circuit Court judge came to the state police post and picked up the trial judge and took him home. And, you know, did that have a factor in the judge allowing some of these things at trial?
I don't know, but
it's something to think about.
Yeah, it does sound like, by the way, listeners who may be hearing some interference, this is like the times we're in. It sounds like another Skype call with lots of people with cool accents is sometimes interfering on ours. So just please bear with us. What was the timing of that arrest relative to the Fred Freeman trial?
Well, the troopers estimated that it was 1 to 2 years prior to the trial.
Okay, yeah.
But I've attempted to find the police report because they said they did a police report on it. They filled out tickets. But up to this point, I haven't been able to get a copy of the police report. The state police advised me that I need to pinpoint the date closer to be able to find that report. And so far, they haven't been able to find it.
Hmm. Colin, this sounds like right up the alley of the kind of thing that Undisclosed would typically look into. What do you think of this idea that the judge may have owed the police in some way? I mean, is this something that holds water? Is it something that you would be nervous about looking into? What do you think?
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, Herb has done this investigation and it seems like a possibility. We just didn't have enough information that we could corroborate on it to present it there on the podcast. But the issue of judicial bias is certainly something that has played out potentially in the appellate process, whereas we noted the prosecutor in the case has since become a federal judge. So there are definitely some rabbit holes to look down with judicial bias here, but we just didn't have enough yet to put that in one of the episodes.
Colin, can you talk a little bit about your decision to talk about a possible other suspect and not name them? I'd love for the listeners to get a chance to sort of hear how you guys made that decision ethically, but then also, you know, made decisions around what you did choose to include around this, you know, the potential motivation here, in a sense, talking about how the victim was potentially had involvements that may have led to a motive, and then the decision to not name the alternate suspect at all.
Yeah, so part of that, as we said, was, you know, Harold Kopis, who had some involvement in the Joy Watkins case that we covered earlier. He did a lot of the legwork in interviewing people and finding about this drug issue and that the picture portrayed of the victim in this case might not have been complete. And then really it's Herb who has pursued this theory of the alternate suspect and has given me some reports and information. Unfortunately, as to this point, I haven't been able to speak with the attorney who has spoken to DC Hill about this alternate suspect. But, you know, you can't really always rely upon what people in jailhouses tell you. We see that obviously with Philip Joplin here. But there's a pretty high level of detail in what DC Hill is saying about this alternate suspect, which is why we presented it on the podcast. But didn't feel comfortable enough naming the alternate suspect because, again, it's just something we haven't been able to corroborate enough to be able to say definitively that we think this person is involved. But it's certainly something, and I'm in communications with the Conviction Integrity Unit, that we hope that they explore more fully once they're back up and running.
I was very interested to hear that there was a tip on the same day that Freeman was arrested and that the tip wasn't pursued. I have that right, right?
Correct. There's the anonymous tip about the Ford Escort was the afternoon, the same afternoon of the day where earlier in the day Freeman had been arrested.
Hmm. Herb, did you want to talk a little bit about your work on finding the alternate potential alternate suspect and, you know, anything aside from we obviously don't want to name that person, but anything else that you think the audience should know that maybe adds weight to the idea that this other person may have done it?
Well, actually, there's four persons of interest that I've received information that may possibly be involved in the murder of Scott Macklem. All of the persons are still alive and live here in the United States. But whether this information is credible, I don't know. You know, I've often thought about, was this possibly a random thrill killing? You know, who would pick 9 o'clock in the morning in a college parking lot with all these students and faculty coming and going through the parking lot? Why would they pick that to kill somebody? You know, maybe this was just a thrill killing. I don't know. All I know is that Fred Freeman is innocent, but I would love to find out who did it, and I'm working on it.
Hmm. Paula, we did hear in the episode, I just want to touch on this now because I think that, you know, between our background noise and our Skype interference, obviously COVID-19 is sort of hanging over everything right now. And we heard in the episode about how Temujin is holding up in prison right now with the outbreak going on. Can you talk a little bit more about that and about, you know, one of the most disturbing things in episode 4 for me was hearing that prisoners were being sanctioned if they said that they had symptoms that might be consistent with COVID-19. How is he holding up?
So sure, prison, I mean, is not a place anybody wants to be during a pandemic, you know, especially with underlying health conditions that make you prone to COVID-19 like Temujin has. So Temujin's been extremely frustrated with the way that the MDOC has been handling this situation. His prison's one of the most infected in the nation. And, you know, he's frustrated with the way that they are shuffling people around and moving people around, it seems, with no apparent reason. And he's just very frustrated by that. You know, he said that anybody who's tested positive is being punished really by being put into isolation and having their possessions taken. And then they're also not allowed to have any phone calls. So, I mean, I think despite the many legal proceedings, the other thing that's frustrating for him is that, you know, prisoners aren't allowed to get their daily exercise like they should be. They've only are allowed really outside one time a week for one hour a week to walk around in a circle. And, you know, they're using COVID as an excuse really to prevent them from the right to exercise. And that's been frustrating for him as well.
Imran, what do you think about that? I know that you probably have other clients who are dealing with similar situations. How do you feel, you know, people are being treated right now, incarcerated people, not just, by the way, wrongfully incarcerated people, but incarcerated people in general in the area where you are around this pandemic?
Yeah, I guess I should preface by saying that, you know, there's the story that I've heard from my clients, including Fred Freeman. And then there's a story that, you know, we read about in the newspapers from the Department of Corrections officials. And the two stories often are different. You know, I'm not in a position to sit here and tell you here's what's really happening, but, you know, I have heard similar stories from a lot of inmates, and it's different from different facilities. I think a lot of it comes down to how staff are choosing to enact certain orders that are coming. You know, for example, inmates are usually not allowed to have any bleach, but now it's been said that they can have bleach to disinfect their items and their areas and all of that stuff. But what we've heard is, at least in one prison, you know, the person in charge has said, no, I'm still not going to give you bleach because I'm deciding it's too dangerous or whatever. And, you know, we've heard things that have been reported in the paper as well. So it wouldn't just be, you know, just rumors that some inmates have been told that, you know, by guards in no uncertain terms that they're not the priority when it comes to protecting someone in a prison. In addition to, you know, obviously certain staff members not following directives that are coming down to, you know, protect the well-being of inmates in prison and prevent the spread of the virus. I think a lot of it also just has to do with prisons are an environment where you cannot really have meaningful social distancing. And you can't have, you know, the kinds of things we take for granted out here. I'm hand sanitizing, you know, after I touch anything and everything, washing my hands, all of that. And, you know, prison's a restrictive environment, and that's not always possible. I was looking at some of the largest clusters of outbreaks on the New York Times website, and, you know, virtually all of them are prisons, including, you know, Fred's is on the list there, too. So, you know, that kind of goes into what we've asked the governor and other officials to do as far as trying to reduce the population in prisons, not just in jails, because I think jails across the country and here in Michigan have done a lot in terms of releasing people who are nonviolent offenders or whose release date was coming up anyway. Prisons, at least in Michigan, have not been quite as active in taking those steps. I know our parole board has paroled a lot of people.
It's interesting, and this is a little bit of a side note, but I think it's important to note that, you know, where all of the big outbreaks are happening, prisons, nursing homes is another big one, are tightly controlled environments where you would think protections would be the easiest to enact. It's like the only people going in and out are employees. You have a static population, and you have the ability to establish tight controls. And of course, these places too, prisons and nursing homes, are some of the most underfunded and under-resourced institutions in our country. So it just speaks to the inequity, I think, that, you know, these potentially safest harbors for people to remain isolated from the virus are becoming the most dangerous. And it says a lot about, I think, the choices that we make as a society in some ways. We did hear, Imran, about another inmate, Kevin Harrington, who was released during the pandemic. You worked on his case, right?
Yeah. So Kevin Harrington was another one of my clients. He's actually one of my very first clients. And I started working on his case when I was a law student in 2009. So a little bit further back even than when I started on Fred's case. And Kevin was in the same prison, actually, where Fred is currently. So Kevin's is another one of those cases that, you know, the man should have never been convicted. He actually had four trials before he was finally convicted. You know, he was convicted at his first one, then a new trial was granted. There were two hung juries, and then they tried a fourth time and finally convicted him. So, and that was a Wayne County case. That's where the city of Detroit is. Kevin's case is from a city right outside of Detroit. But, you know, that was an indicator that this was a case that the county invested a massive amount of resources in to convict Kevin based on very, very thin evidence. And, you know, even though we had litigated his case for several years, I by no means thought we were approaching the finish line in his case. I thought we still had a very long fight ahead for many years. But what changed everything in Wayne County was the creation of a fantastic new conviction integrity unit there.
Yes.
Which has just created possibilities that just would have never existed. The unit, you know, my only complaint about it is that it's too small and it can't, you know, affect even more cases than it already does. But Kevin's is a perfect example. Once the CIU started looking into it, and, you know, thankfully this is one of those conviction integrity units that's staffed by truly independent people, not just people who are there to rubber stamp convictions. And they saw that the witness in Kevin's case had been coerced by police, and they weren't afraid to say that. And, you know, probably only about 3 or 4 months they investigated the case before they made the decision that they were going to recommend that the charges be dismissed and Kevin and his co-defendant would be released. And then the outbreak of COVID-19, I think, did speed that up. And I give the prosecution a lot of credit there, not only for creating this unit and for reviewing this case, but also when the virus happened, for speeding up their review. Mm-hmm. It's how I would think such cases should be treated. I mean, it should be a huge priority if you have someone in prison who shouldn't be there, especially at a dangerous time like this. Unfortunately, that's not a priority that I've seen shared by, you know, across the board by other actors who have similar powers to, you know, release certain individuals.
Yeah. You know, Colin, last week on my podcast, Toby Ball made the comment that it's a pretty low bar when there are people that we uphold as sort of heroes in the system who their basic mission is just to get innocent people out of prison. Like, that's a pretty low bar to be considered a hero. It should be the way that everybody wants to operate, right?
Yeah, I mean, everyone should have an interest in the wrongfully convicted being released. It's about securing justice, not just for the wrongfully convicted, but the victim as well, right? There's a real victim in this case, Scott Maglum and his family. And it does them no justice to have the wrong person incarcerated for 3.5 decades. And so, yeah, I mean, all these cases, there's the victim being both the person who had their life taken as well as the person who is wrongfully in prison for years.
Hmm. Well, we do have some questions from listeners that I want to get to. A question for you, Herb. This is from @Piccola1922 on Twitter. And he or she says, I'm interested in this case being finally investigated. I understand you can't reveal the name of the alternate suspect. Is this person still out in the world? or did they become incarcerated for some other unrelated charges? Can you tell us the answer to that question or not, Herb?
Well, I can say that one of the persons that was mentioned earlier in a podcast is in prison here in Michigan. But that's only one of four persons that may be possibly involved. I've received information as far as the murder of Scott Macklem. So that's something that's still under investigation.
Hmm. Now, question for you, Imran. All right, this is from a listener who wants to know, we heard in the episode about the appeals to Governor Whitmer and the CIU application. We know that the CIU application has been delayed by COVID-19 just because the process is being slowed down. But are there any updates that listeners can know about? Or are there anything that listeners can do besides maybe getting Governor Whitmer to listen to Undisclosed, for goodness sakes? Someone tweet to her.
Yeah, I think that would be great. So, yes, we do have the clemency application pending, as well as the application in the Conviction Integrity Unit. Now, this is a different unit. This is in the Attorney General's office. And yeah, that unit is very new and I think really didn't get off the ground before all the COVID-19 restrictions came into place. So I have hope that, you know, those will be reviewed meaningfully. You know, I think we have a governor who wants to do the right thing. I just think, unfortunately, with everything else going on, she isn't prioritizing this sort of thing, clemency for inmates. I think there's other stuff on her plate that she's going for at this time.
You mean like being vetted as a potential vice presidential candidate?
Yeah, so we hear that news as well. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, and it's unfortunate because this truly, as she's recognized, is an emergency. And it's an emergency for people like Fred, who have underlying conditions that make them vulnerable and are housed in prisons that, you know, have significant clusters of this virus. So it's an emergency, but I think, unfortunately, it isn't being treated that way. I think the best hope I have right now is that it will be looked at meaningfully in a way that it wasn't under, you know, previous administrations. And, you know, hopefully we'll get someone to review kind of the underlying substance of this case, because I think if any neutral person looks at the substance, they kind of come away just thinking, how is this even possible?
Yeah.
And there can be two reactions to that. One is, well, it shouldn't have been possible and this man shouldn't be in prison and let me fix that. But unfortunately, the other reaction is just kind of being in denial and, you know, just assuming that there must be more to it than we're saying. They're assuming there must be things we're not telling them. And, you know, I don't want anyone to assume anything. I mean, if there's other evidence that supports the conviction that's strong, I mean, bring that forward. Unfortunately, that's never what happens. The response to every time that Fred has filed an application is never, well, here's the evidence that he committed this crime. The response is always, Fred is an aggressive person who, you know, has brainwashed everybody into believing these things. And, you know, it's just, it's kind of frustrating. No one will engage with you on a fact-to-fact basis. They want to close the book on the facts and just talk about how, oh, well, he's just always filing things and he's always just pointing the finger at someone else. You know, I don't blame him for that. I mean, if I'm an innocent person sitting in prison, I'm going to be pointing the finger at anybody that I get an allegation about. I mean, if I didn't do it, you know, I'm gonna try to do everything I can to get out of prison. And that sort of very understandable tenacity that Fred's had kind of gets turned around and used against him.
Right.
It's almost like they're blaming him for trying too hard to get out of prison.
Right.
And I give a lot of support to, and have a lot of sympathy for him and all of his advocates, Herb and others proving innocence, who have, you know, been just undaunted by that, because they get told that they're wrong and they don't know what they're talking about and they've been brainwashed and they're, you know, supporting a murderer. Yet they fought through all of that and just, you know, letter after letter, appeal after appeal. They've been invaluable to us as his attorneys in, you know, directing us to important witnesses and all of those things. So I do think from having worked on these cases that this will work out eventually. And that's just not an ideal answer, though, especially in a time of this virus when Fred's already served 33 years in prison, you know?
I do know. These things take way too long, even when the answer is obvious and clear. And for me, it's never been more obvious and clear than it is in this case. Imran, just for the sake of our technology, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for speaking to me about this case. It was a real pleasure getting to meet you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Paula, are you still with us?
I am.
Paula, a question for you from Twitter. Raymond Wilson wants to know, is the Twitter account for Temujin being run By Temujin or by somebody else? I think I might know the answer to that question, but can you clarify that?
Sure. It's being run by me, and I'm very close to being fired by Temujin because he pointed out my multiple spelling and grammar errors.
Oh, stop it. He needs to knock that off.
I attribute it to no sleep, which is the absolute truth, but he's not buying it.
Does he have any opportunity to listen to these podcasts at all?
He cannot listen to these.
Okay, maybe you can send him the transcript. I'm going to say something to him right now. Temujin, Paula is trying to get you out of prison. Complaining about her spelling and grammar is unproductive and mean. Knock it off. Okay, Paula, what were you saying?
No, I mean, his sister was very funny. We actually joked quite a bit about it. And he tells me every single day how much he appreciates the efforts that I'm doing on the social media front on his behalf. So, it's an important vehicle. We really think that this is the most powerful resource we have. Because it has the most impact and influence. And we think that, you know, his release is probably only going to happen when supporters raise their voice on his behalf to the governor. So thank you to everybody who has done that already for us from the bottom of our heart, really. It's your collective voices that are really going to prompt the action that we need to release them.
Well, Paula, I could have said it better myself, and I'm sure that you telling our listeners to do that will inspire them too. Thank you so much for talking to me about this case. I know you've had some technical challenges living all the way up there when the thumb, is that what you called it?
Yes.
I appreciate you roving around trying to find a good spot to get connectivity to us, and it was wonderful getting to meet you.
It was great to speak with you. Thank you so much for all that you do.
Thanks. Thanks, Paula. So, Herb, I have a question for you. This is your last chance. You know every detail about this investigation. Is there anything else that you really want people to take away or know about this case, about Temujin, about your work? This is your chance to give people one more thing to hold on to have them, inspire them to make that phone call and, you know, demand that this case get a closer look.
Well, since the podcast had posted, I've had two persons who have been listening to them who I respect their opinion very much. And they have told me that in listening to Fred Freeman that he sounds like a con man. Mm. And I have to agree with him. The way that Fred comes across when he speaks at times, as a police officer for 30 years, I conducted many interrogations and interviews. I used to have a nickname at the police department where the officers would refer to me as Father Herb. And the reason is because of all the confessions that I obtained from suspects. And I can say that in working on this case for 13 years, I've never caught Fred Freeman lying to me about anything. And in my opinion, I think that Fred can be his own worst enemy. I truly believe that there's those here in the community that believe in his innocence, but they've heard some of his theories as to the reason that Scott Macklin was killed, one of which may be drugs, and there's no proof of that at all yet. Some of Fred's statements about the prosecutors, the law enforcement, and how corrupt they were, and some of this just isn't true. And those people who may be able to help Fred are thinking probably, well, why should I try to help this guy?
Mm.
In a recent podcast, Fred mentioned by name the officers and called them corrupt. And he may have been told that by someone, but not me. And for him to say things like that without evidence, it just hurts his case. But what it comes down to is that look at all of the people who have worked on this case before me. I look back through the notes of private investigators that have worked on it, retired state police officers, retired FBI agents, retired judges, attorneys, journalists, the media, and even right now, the Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court worked on this case for Fred Freeman, along with a previous Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court. So my question would be, have all of these persons been fooled by a con man? And I really believe the answer is absolutely not. We all believe in his innocence. And in spite of Fred Freeman's flaws, all of these people have worked on this case and are convinced of his innocence.
Hmm. Well, Herb, I'm convinced of his innocence because there's no way he could have done it. And I have to tell you, it has been so great to get to talk to you, an investigator who's been working on this case, especially with your perspective as a former police officer. Thank you so much for coming to these two conversations. It's been really great meeting you.
Well, thank you very much, Rebecca. Nice talking to you.
So, Colin, I have to ask you, you've gotten tons of feedback from listeners that this is the most obvious wrongful conviction that's ever been covered on your podcast. I have to say I agree. I think many of the cases that you've covered, for me, it's been obvious, but I understand, at least on some level, why people with certain biases or people who, you know, haven't seen all of the information or read all the documents, you know, would still hang on to the belief that somebody may be guilty or just say they don't know. This is not like that. This is far more black and white. Do you have final thoughts about this case and what you hope will happen at this point?
Yeah, well, I mean, to the point you are making, Rebecca, we've covered a number of cases on this podcast, and a lot of times our focus is on there was misconduct here, defense counsel was ineffective, here's some evidence of innocence. What we have here is, and this is the point you're making about the impossibility, we have these witnesses in the Upper Peninsula, and to the point that Herb was just making, they're not necessarily the biggest fans of Fred. We have this conversation at the karate studio about fat nurses, where Fred Freeman is calling nurses, you know, fat and unhealthy. And so this witness at the karate studio has no reason to provide an alibi for Fred Freeman, and yet she's saying he's there at the karate studio 3 hours after the murder. And that's what leads to the creation of this crazy plane theory that, of course, has no support in the evidence. And so I think that's the point you're making where, yes, we present a lot of cases where we think the client is innocent and there's some strong evidence. But here, it's just an impossibility. There's no way that Fred Freeman committed this crime. In terms of what I hope happens, I mean, yeah. Certainly I think there's a decent chance that Governor Whitmer here grants clemency. You mentioned that she could be a vice presidential candidate. Governors love to grant clemency as they are leaving office because that's not in their record then where yeah. they're still in office. And so if she is appointed vice president by Biden in the candidacy, that would be a great shot for clemency. Beyond that, you know, in talking with Robin Frankel, the head of the new CIU, obviously their efforts have been sort of waylaid by COVID-19, but she, as I said in the episode, is very much similar to Patricia Cummings, the head of the Philadelphia CIU, and the Philadelphia CIU has been tremendous in working with us after the cases of Willie Vesey and Terrence Lewis and Chester Holman, where we continue a dialogue and give them evidence and they tell us what they're doing. And so I have every hope and expectation that once things hopefully return back to normal, we'll be able to work with them. And based on what we've discussed about the strong evidence of innocence here, I think that while it might be a little while, I think eventually we can get an exoneration here by the CIU.
I keep thinking about what Herb just said about, you know, Fred sounding like a con man, you know, coming off as a BS artist. He didn't say that. I'm paraphrasing. You know, I can't disagree. He's an unusual character. You know, even just him talking about himself back in the 80s and his tight pants and his karate and his tomcatting around and all that stuff. But I have a theory about incarcerated people. I just want to ask you if this is consistent with, you know, what you've experienced. We have to remember that people who are incarcerated, like, never meet anyone new, ever, in the course of their daily existence. They don't encounter new people to whom they get to tell their story. Mm-hmm. And I do think there's an impassioned storytelling, sort of hope for connection that people behind bars feel when they get to tell their story, when they get to have conversations. I imagine, you know, Temujin talking to you on the phone and just being like gung-ho to tell you about his whole story and his whole life. And it can be a lot, but it doesn't reflect whether or not someone is innocent or guilty just because they happen to be, you know, have a gift of gab and be like really wanting to make that connection and getting their story out there, right? I mean, I think that that's what may be going on here too.
Yeah, I think that's true on one front. And the second front, which also goes to your point, is that certainly for someone like Fred Freeman, over these 3.5 decades, he literally spends every day thinking about everything that went into his trial, reading through documents, papers, etc. And, you know, you have to imagine that's part of what keeps you going and preoccupied is thinking, oh my God, this happened, that happened, maybe this happened, you know, hypotheticals to the point that Herb was making. And so you just want to share all these theories, sometimes crazy, sometimes not. But yeah, I mean, that is such a big part of your life when you're fighting to prove your innocence over all these years, is you're just going through, you know, what happened, what could have happened. And so I think that impacts it as well.
All right. Well, Colin, I honestly, this has been one of the most fun series I've ever produced for Undisclosed. Of course, it's never fun to be talking about somebody who's been wrongfully convicted and somebody who's been murdered. However, the absurdity of this case, I've had so many oh shit moments when I've been doing your editing. And I can't thank you enough for bringing this case, not just to my attention, but the attention of all of your listeners. Really, really spectacular work. And I really do believe that your work is going to make a difference here. So thank you, Colin.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to everybody who joined me for this conversation this week. And thanks to you, listeners, for persevering through our tech challenges. I hope after the final edit, you didn't hear too many of them. Our editor is Hannah McCarthy, and she is a brilliant audio producer. If you have questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can always ask them on social media. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Production again for the addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. And if you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime review podcast. It's called Crime Writers On. Thanks so much to executive producer Methil Telhan and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for continuing to let me be a part of their important work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening, and there's a lot more to come.
Get
Colin, your connection is terrible.
That's not me.
Oh, it's not you? Hey, Paula, is that you?
Probably me.
Paula, you know, would you mind just muting your phone when we're not talking to you? Because you have some strange noises coming down your line.
Oh, I have been. I've been on mute.
Okay. Oh, okay. So maybe it's Herb. Okay. Never mind.
I am cutting in and out, but...
Okay. All right. So what were we saying? Okay. So we're saying in 2000, okay. So I don't know if you guys heard that. You guys heard that weird noise, right?
Yes.
Okay. Just checking.
And, you know, a lot of this goes back to...
All right, just hold on a sec. Sorry about all this. Don't worry, this isn't going to go on forever. It's okay if we just have to just wait. Okay. Everyone hears that incoming call, yeah. Right? That's awesome.
Is that someone calling us or no?
Nope. It just think we're getting interference. Methil, you hear that, right?
I sure do. I think we're good now.
Okay. You know, part of the challenge is just that.
Sorry.
Now we're getting a message. It's not available.
Please record your message. Are we going to listen to the message?
This has to be in the outtakes.
Hey,
And, you know, Kevin's is another really head scratching case. It's, you know.
I believe. We have...
The only comfort I have right now is that they can hear us too. And they're like, why do they keep talking about prisons on that other call?
Right, right.
This is a head scratching case.